So thank you, and thanks to the organizers. What I'm going to talk about is joint work with Greg Moore and Graham Siegel. And the uncertainty in the title is a Heisenberg uncertainty. And so what we've observed is a Heisenberg uncertainty principle between magnetic and electric flux. So the statement is that you cannot simultaneously measure magnetic and electric flux. Now, that may sound very interesting, but I should give an immediate caveat, which is that the statement is really about torsion fluxes. So you can measure simultaneously magnetic and electric flux modulo torsion, but the effect that I'm going to talk about is something related to torsion, as I'll explain. So in the context of four-dimensional electromagnetism, Maxwell's equations, we found out that this was previously observed in a paper of Gukov, Rangamani, and Witten, and who were studying the ADS-CFT correspondence, and in particular were led to look at Maxwell's equations on a lens space. And so there you have torsion. And in fact, they related their observations to previous work of Gopakumar and Vafa. But the observation we're making here about this Heisenberg uncertainty between these fluxes is actually quite general and applies to any abelian gauge field. And so in particular, it applies to the Ramon-Ramon field in type 2 string theory, or the Ramon-Ramon field in type 1 string theory. And the fluxes of that type of that Ramon-Ramon field are generally thought to be in K-theory. So they're thought to be given by a K-theory class on a nine-dimensional space. You're studying a 10-dimensional space-time in a Hamiltonian picture where you have a nine-dimensional manifold as your space, and the fluxes are thought to be classified by the K-theory of that nine-dimensional space, which is an abelian group that may include torsion. So you might think that the Hilbert space of that theory is actually graded into superselection sectors, which are indexed by the K-theory of that space. But in fact, what we'll show is that you can only make that kind of grading by the K-theory modulo of the torsion, that you cannot, in fact, measure that K-theory class. So I'm not quite sure what implications that has for the standard thoughts about D-brains and Ramon-Ramon charge and Ramon-Ramon flux, but there it is. So I should say that the statements we're making are really statements about free fields, and free fields are one of the few things, I would say, that we understand mathematically. So I can say all the statements in a mathematical framework, and Heisenberg again comes because when we study free fields, we understand them as representations of Heisenberg groups. So I'm going to spend some time talking about this in the four-dimensional Maxwell theory, where the notions are most familiar and the geometry is most easy to explain. And then I'll try to say something about how you say this for other gauge fields, like the Ramon-Ramon field, where there are two issues one has to come to grips with. One is that other cohomology theories, like K-theory, enter the game. And the second is this concept of a self-dual field. So part of what we're doing is clarifying a little bit what a self-dual field is. So I should say that really what's behind this phenomenon is the quantization of charge, and therefore quantization of flux, which the Dirac quantization of charge. And that's where one introduces these cohomology theories to.
So self-duality of a field could be viewed as a reduction of a bigger Hilbert space to a subspace, in which in the bigger Hilbert space you might have a commutation probability which is absent in the reduced one. So that notion of self-duality, the reason I say this for physicists, is more familiar in the context of a lowest Landau level kind of non-commutativity of space, where you reduce to subspace, that happens. So if you didn't have self-duality, you wouldn't have this.
Even for the standard Maxwell field.
For the standard one.
You have
but
this
you
non-commutativity.
Self-duality is what the issue is.
No, I'm saying that it applies to self-dual fields as well. In fact, we could view the Maxwell theory field as a self-dual field by sort of doubling. Consider simultaneously the field and its dual field, but consider that pair as self-dual. But the observation applies just to the standard Maxwell field, and that's what I'll explain. Okay, so to explain the standard Maxwell field, we'll work on a space, N, which is a compact oriented Riemannian manifold. So the compactness could be eliminated. I'm just taking it to be compact so I don't have to talk about what happens at infinity. And even the orientation could be eliminated. We could use twistings related to orientation. But let's take it like this. And so a typical example you might think of, well, the typical example you study in physics is, of course, the non-compact, just Euclidean space. And so Euclidean free space. And we might remove some finite number of points. And those points could be the location of point charges, electric and magnetic charges, and that will induce fluxes that you would measure. You won't encounter any torsion in that example, but an example where you would encounter torsion would be something, as I said before, like a three-dimensional lens space, which is the quotient of a three-sphere by a cyclic group. And then we could even remove some points from there if you want some point sources. Okay, so the Maxwell field, so I'm going to talk first about the classical Maxwell equation, just to say what flux is and so on. So the field, the electromagnetic field, is a two-form on space-time, which I forgot to say here. Space-time is just the product of time and space, R cross N. And the Maxwell equations are simply the equations df equals 0 and d star f equals 0, where this star is the Hodge star for the Lorentz metric. So we give this product here, the Lorentz metric, as usual. And that's the standard Maxwell equation. So those are linear equations. And so let's define V to be the space of solutions. So V is some infinite dimensional vector space. And let's say I'm just thinking of smooth solutions. So what are the fluxes? Well, if we have, so the classical flux, we take a surface, say sigma, sitting inside space. And so this will be a closed and oriented surface. And we want to measure the flux around sigma. And so the flux around sigma, so let's say the classical magnetic flux, if we have a solution f here, then this is just the integral over sigma of f. But f is a field in space-time, so we're really integrating at some fixed time across sigma f. And the electric flux is just the integral of the Hodge star of f, as everybody knows. And Maxwell's equations imply that this integral is independent of time. And not only that, but if I move the surface sigma through a homology, I also get the same answer. So in fact, these fluxes, the magnetic and electric flux, are functions from the space of solutions to Maxwell's equations and a homology class in space to the real numbers. They just give us a real number. Or we could view it as a function from the space of solutions to the cohomology of n with real coefficients.
The integral is not present for you.
And the important point here is that in this classical theory, I haven't imposed yet any kind of integrality. The whole point is later to impose it and see what changes. But in the classical Maxwell theory, we don't have that integrality. So this is a linear function, or a homomorphism from this group to R, and therefore it's an element of that cohomology. So the fluxes you could think of as functions on the space of solutions with values in that cohomology group, in the real cohomology. And we can simply say what these functions are, you see. From that point of view, when I evaluate on f, I just take f is a closed two-form because of Maxwell's equations. I just take its Durham cohomology class, and that's a class in H2 of n with real coefficients. And the electric flux, from this point of view, is just the Durham cohomology class of the Hodge star. Okay. So that's what the fluxes are. They're just the cohomology classes of the electromagnetic field. All right.
Cohomology classes should be in H2 of m, shouldn't they?
That's correct. But m's, our space-time in this Hamiltonian picture, is the product of time cross space. And so the cohomology of R cross N is the same as the cohomology of N. So I've written it as the cohomology of N. Okay, so the claim in this classical setting is that the magnetic and the electric fluxes commute. Now, what do I mean by commute in the classical setting? I mean that they Poisson commute. And so to say what that means, we have to write Maxwell's equations as a Hamiltonian system. And by that I mean we have to introduce, on this vector space of solutions, Poisson brackets, view these as functions on V, and then I'm saying that their Poisson bracket is zero. So, well, I'm not going to write the formulas for how you introduce Poisson brackets. Maybe I should just say that to carry out this sort of Hamiltonian thing straightforward, we write F, we decompose it in terms of time. So we write it as a two-form. B of t is a two-form on n for each time t. E of t is a one-form on n. So I have a curve of two forms and a curve of one forms. I write F that way. And then I rewrite Maxwell's equations in terms of this, and we discover that the Maxwell equations are equivalent to saying that B and the Hodge star of E are closed. And so I need a different Hodge star. This is meant to be the Riemannian Hodge star on the three manifold N. So on space, remember space is Riemannian, we have a Hodge star for the positive definite metric. And these are now closed two forms. So the magnetic and electric fields. And then the Maxwell equations give evolution equations, which look like B dot equals minus dE, and star E dot is D star B. So we write the Maxwell equations as evolution equations. We write a Hamiltonian, which is the energy. That's 1/2 the integral of B wedge star B plus E wedge star E. And now we want to introduce Poisson brackets so that these evolution equations are, of course, the Poisson bracket of H with B. And this is the Poisson bracket of H with E. So we can do that. We can introduce such Poisson brackets. I won't write down the formula. But let me just give you a picture of structure. So notice that this vector space of solutions, that if we evaluate at time t, so an element of V is an electromagnetic field on space-time. But if we evaluate at a fixed time V, then what we can do is send F at time t. We can send it to the pair consisting of the magnetic field and the electric field, except we'll take the Hodge star. That's just an invertible transformation. And so we'll get a two-form on N, which is closed, cross a two-form on N, another closed two-form. And that's an isomorphism. So we can think of the space of solutions as being given by this data at time t, initial sort of data, which is the magnetic and electric field at time t. And then we have the evolution equations. And so it's the cohomology classes of these, which are the fluxes. Those don't change with time. And so we have a map from V down to the product of these Durham cohomology groups. Where I take a pair consisting of a B and the Hodge star of E, and I just map to the cohomology classes, say the Durham cohomology classes. And then there's some fiber here, which is the fiber over zero is the vector space where these fluxes are zero. And in general, I have a bundle whose fibers are affine spaces. They're affine copies of this. And the Poisson structure is degenerate. So if you have a Poisson manifold, here it's just linear. It's a linear vector space with a Poisson bracket. If it's invertible, then we can invert the Poisson structure and get a symplectic structure. So then I would have told you it was a symplectic vector space. In fact, in this case, we don't get invertible Poisson brackets, but the Poisson brackets are invertible along the fibers of this map pi. So the fibers are what are called the symplectic leaves of the Poisson structure. And but they're degenerate, so to speak, in these directions. So we're used to thinking of classical mechanical or classical field theory systems as being given by a symplectic manifold with a motion and so on. At least I'm used to thinking about that. But in fact, we should think more generally that they're given by Poisson structures and that the Poisson structure might not be invertible. After all, to write down Hamilton's equations, what we need is not a symplectic form, but we need Poisson brackets. So that's a more general notion. And it's typical in field theory, actually, when you think about it. If you had a scalar field where you have a non-compact space, then specifying the value of the field in infinity, that will be a sort of degenerate direction for Poisson brackets. And it's only when you specify that that you'll get a symplectic situation. So this is similar. We're not specifying a value of a scalar field in infinity, but we're fixing these cohomology classes of the fluxes. And once we do that, we get a symplectic situation, which are the fibers here. Okay. Well, so you can see from this picture of the Poisson bracket I've given you, not the formula, that in fact the fluxes commute, because the fluxes are these functions, pi. All right. So even though this is the picture without charge quantization, and therefore not the correct quantum picture, we could think about what this picture, this classical picture, would lead to in a quantum picture. In other words, how would you quantize this for a Poisson situation? And I think what you would do is just quantize the symplectic leaves, in other words, the fibers of pi, and you would leave the base fixed. So in other words, you see, the fibers of pi are affine symplectic vector spaces, and we know how to quantize those. Those are just the canonical commutation relations in flat space. And so we know how to construct a Hilbert space for each of these fibers. And so what we will get is a family of Hilbert spaces parameterized by these fluxes. So you would say that that's a moduli problem, right? And we have a sort of family of systems here. And that the parameter in the system is given by the fluxes. So of course, in that picture, we would think of the Hilbert spaces as graded, if you like, by the fluxes. Here the fluxes are real. They're living in a vector space. But nevertheless, we can simultaneously measure in that picture the magnetic and electric fluxes, certainly. We just pick that point, and then we do our quantum mechanics in the Hilbert space associated to the fiber. So in that picture, the fluxes commute even quantum mechanically. All right. So what gives rise to this non-commutation, as I said, is the Dirac charge and hence flux quantization. So how do we say what that is? Well, we started with a two-form, which is closed, let's say on M. So this is our electromagnetic field. And the magnetic flux that we look at is a map to H2M. So this is just the Durham cohomology class of F. That's the magnetic flux. And now we want to impose a condition that we don't allow this flux to be arbitrary. In other words, these integrals over surfaces, we don't allow to be arbitrary real numbers. But we want them. In fact, if we integrate over a closed surface, we want to ask that the answer be an integer. And asking that the answer be an integer is saying that this cohomology class lives in a certain lattice, a full rank lattice, sublattice of this vector space, where the differential form, the closed differential form, has integral periods. In other words, its integral over every close oriented surface is an integer. So that specifies a full lattice. And the way to describe that lattice is to say that we have the integer cohomology. And we look at the image of the integer cohomology inside the real cohomology. Now, the integer cohomology is an abelian group, but it's not necessarily free. It might have torsion. And this map kills the torsion. Okay? So what's natural, once you introduce this idea that the charge in this vector space lives in this lattice, is to think that the flux is actually, this flux in the real cohomology is just an image of some more refined flux which lives here. So we'd really like to think that there's some magnetic flux. What should I write it? Magnetic flux of F, which lives in there, and that it maps to this cohomology class of the electromagnetic field. So in other words, we'd like to think the electromagnetic field not only carries the information as a closed differential form of its Durham cohomology class, but it somehow carries integral information as well. And if we're going to do that, then we need a different model of an electromagnetic field, a model that's not simply this differential form, because from this differential form we can't recover this integral information. So the most naive way to do that would be to take what's called the fiber product of this diagram, of these two maps, and that means we would consider a pair consisting of a closed differential form and an integral cohomology class such that the Durham class here, that you get by this arrow, agrees with the image of that class here. We would just consider that pair. In fact, that's not the right answer. And the right answer, as you know, is to consider instead the space I'll call A of n, n or m, I guess. And so the script A of m is the following. So A of m is the set of, let's say, circle connections up to some equivalence. And so, in other words, a circle connection means a pair consisting of a principal circle bundle and a connection. And the equivalence you can think of is really gauge transformations. Okay. So in other words, I consider a U1 gauge field up to gauge transformations, but I allow arbitrary bundles. So, of course, if my manifold M is just flat Minkowski spacetime, then there's only one isomorphism class of bundle. They're all trivial bundles. But if I have something like time cross a Lens space, then there could be different topological types of these bundles, and we want to allow all those different types. Okay? So the space of connections, well, it maps here, because given a connection A, this maps now to the curvature of A. Right. So this is the curvature, or maybe the curvature mod 2 pi I. And on the other hand, given a connection A, we can get a integer cohomology class, because the integer cohomology classes are just the equivalence classes of principal bundles without connection. So this map is just forgetting the connection, or if you like, taking the first string class of that bundle. Okay. So we know something that fits in this diagram. In other words, it maps to these, and then this diagram commutes. They give you the same thing here. But it's not really the fiber product. It's somewhat bigger. Because supposing we have a flat connection. Well, a flat connection, that's the kernel of this horizontal arrow. Those are the connections where the curvature is zero. On the other hand, we have a kernel for this vertical arrow. That's just saying that the bundle P is a trivial bundle, trivializable bundle. So can we have a flat connection on a bundle which is trivial? And the answer is yes, depending on the space M. For example, if M is a circle, then there's no second cohomology. Every circle bundle is trivial. On the other hand, every two-form is also trivial. And yet we can still have monodromy around that circle. Okay. So this space is somewhat bigger than just naively taking this electromagnetic field and brutally giving a cohomology class. That's sort of closely related to the fact that a gauge field is not an equivalence class of connections, but a gauge field is, in fact, a connection. And connections have automorphisms. And when you're dealing with gauge theory, you know that you have to take into account these automorphisms. Those have physical effects. And it's those automorphisms which make this, what goes here, a little bit bigger than simply that fiber product. So morally, what you should think of it as is not just a cohomology class, but some kind of geometric object which carries that cohomology class, together with a differential form, together not just saying that they're the same equivalence class here, but with some kind of chosen equivalence here, or homotopy. And the set of those choices of something representing this, a form, and an equivalence here, those triples up to some equivalence, that's really what goes here. And that's what the connections play there. So that's a rather long-winded way of telling you why we think of a gauge field in Maxwell theory as being a connection on a circle bundle. It's really that we have in classical electromagnetism, we don't have A at all. We just have the electromagnetic field. A is introduced sometimes. But when we introduce the charge quantization, that's when we're forced into that picture. All right. So now we can redo a classical theory. We might think of it as a semi-classical theory because we've incorporated this quantization of flux. And we can redo it with starting with our gauge field being the A. So now we do this sort of semi-classical Maxwell. And now we're in a better situation because we don't just write down the equations, the Maxwell equations, and say what the space of solutions is. We actually derive them from an action principle. So in this case, we have an action principle, or a Lagrangian, and the Lagrangian is the standard norm squared of the curvature. And so this leads to the Maxwell equation, the Euler-Lagrange equations, that d star f is 0. So the same equation we had before. Notice the equation df equals 0 is automatic because we're saying this is the curvature of a connection. So we get the same equation, but the objects on which we're analyzing that equation is different. And so what does the space of solutions look like now? Well, these Euler-Lagrange equations are sort of standard second-order equations. And it's really a wave equation for A. And so the space of solutions is the tangent bundle to this space A of n. So we really have a standard wave equation. What do we have to do? We have to give an initial value and initial derivative, right? The usual thing for a second-order equation. So that's the Cauchy data for this wave equation. And so that means if we evaluate at some fixed time, we give a connection on space, n, that's our fixed data, and we give a velocity, a derivative for the wave, that's an element of the tangent bundle. And so that's one way to write the space of solutions once we fix a time. And that's symplectic. So this is now better than Poisson. It's actually symplectic. Well, the A is modded out by gauge transformations. So script A is already modded out by gauge transformations. Yeah, so all that went into that. Okay. So if you'd rather, you might tend to call that the cotangent bundle, although I think Cauchy data is generally thought of as a velocity. And but we have a metric around, and that's how we would write the symplectic structure. But in any case, it's derived by a... by an algorithm, say, from the Lagrangian, the symplectic form. All right. Now, there are a few things I want to observe about this. Let's see. One thing is to say that this space A of n is an abelian group. So the space of solutions is the tangent bundle to this abelian group. So why are connections an abelian group? Well, given two circle connections, we can take their tensor product. We can take the tensor product, think instead of circle bundles, of Hermitian line bundles, we can take the tensor product, and we can take the connection that's the tensor product of the connections. So if I do that up to equivalence, then we also have an inverse. We have a nice abelian group. So that's an abelian group. And having the space of fields be an abelian group is really what we mean by an abelian gauge field. So that happens in much more general situations, say for the Ramon-Ramon field as well. Now I want to say a little bit about what's the geometry of this abelian group. So it's not only an abelian group, but it's a topological group. So we don't think of it as discrete. It has a topology. And so for example, what's the space of components, path components of this? Well, the components of this is simply H2 with integer coefficients. In other words, the components are classified by the Chern classes. So you can draw a path from one gauge field to another as long as they're on a connection on the same bundle. And what does each component look like? So if we fix a say B, think of that as the magnetic flux. If we fix a B, then what is the component? So let's say A of N. So B is the component indexed by B. And that component is a principal bundle over an affine space. So let me explain. Supposing we fix a Chern class, then how would we describe a connection with that particular Chern class? Well, we could first give the curvature, or the field strength, and the field strength lives in some affine space. So this is an affine space of possible field strengths. So that's the space of two forms with a fixed Aram cohomology class. It, in fact, only depends on the image of B in there. So that's an affine space. And on the other hand, that doesn't quite determine the connection, because we can always, if we have a connection with a given field strength, we could tensor it by a flat connection. And we'd have to tensor it by a flat connection on the trivial bundle so as not to change components in the space. So what we have here is a bundle for a certain structure group, and it's the group of all flat connections up to equivalence on the trivial bundle. And that group is a torus, and that torus is H1 of N with real coefficients modulo H1 of N with integer coefficients. So I said that we have a full lattice inside here, and therefore we get a quotient torus. And well, that's true in H2, but it's also true in H1. And in degree 1, that torus is the torus of flat connections on the trivial bundle. Okay, so that group acts, and so we have a principal bundle with that structure group. So that's what this space of connections looks like. It has components indexed by an abelian group, this group of magnetic fluxes. Each component has a big affine space, has a base, which is a big affine space of field strengths, and then there's a torus, so over it, or a principal torus bundle, which have to do with the flat fields. Okay.
Can you do this kind of analysis for SU2?
No, SU2 is definitely not abelian. So everything I'm saying here is just for abelian gauge fields. I mean, well, we could do that kind of analysis, but the picture is not so linear.
Right.
We don't have an abelian group structure. We can't tensor, right? So there's no operation of tensoring together two SU2 connections. So I'm strongly using that fact that this is an abelian group.
I was actually more worried about the image describing the absence here from connections.
Well, there again.
I mean, is that even known?
I'm not sure. I don't know a good description of that. Yeah, I mean, really, those curvatures take values in the adjoint bundles, so already it's hard to compare them because, I mean, they already live in a, they transform a little bit. They're not scalar things that I can just compare on the manifold. So I'm not even sure quite how to to formulate that. Okay. Now, we might think about, remember that in the picture before charge quantization, we had the space of solutions mapping down to H2 with real coefficients cross H2 with real coefficients. And this is a Poisson space, and these directions are degenerate. And we did something. We just added charge quantization to get to this non-singular symplectic situation. So what happened here? Well, what happened is that the magnetic flux, if we think of this as the magnetic flux, this real direction just became discrete, became this lattice. And so those directions, infinitesimal directions, tangent directions, disappeared, if you like. But we're still left with the directions of electric flux here. And those electric flux directions are, you know, where do they appear in this other picture? In this picture with the quantization. Well, the electric flux directions are really the tangents to these tori, and now we have the points of the tori become the dual. So in the symplectic pairing, you see pairs those. I mean, it pairs the tangent and those directions. So, in essence, making this discrete and adding that torus is how we went from this degenerate Poisson situation to this invertible symplectic situation. So, one final comment. So how do we see? So the fluxes, I want to say, still commute. So maybe what I should say is the following. Supposing that eta is a closed one form on N, then, of course, that has a cohomology class that defines something in H1 of N with real coefficients. And now we can define a function which is, say, the magnetic flux applied to eta. So if we evaluate that at some connection, all I want to do is integrate over n the wedge product of eta with the curvature. And similarly, we could have an electric flux depending on eta, which is the integral of eta wedge star f. So think of eta as a Poincaré dual form to a surface, and then I would just be integrating over a surface as I did before. So this is a way of making fluxes instead of functions with values in this vector space. We just took an element in the dual vector space to H2, and we made them real valued functions. So this is a way of making them real valued functions. And the claim is that these commute. So again, we want to say that these commute. They Poisson commute. And so why do they Poisson commute in the symplectic picture? Well, they Poisson commute because this function is actually locally constant. You see, this is the wedge product of a closed one form with a closed two form. And when I integrate that product, it just depends on the cohomology classes. But as I move the connection A, the cohomology class of F isn't changing. We're staying in the same component, and that cohomology class became discrete. So this magnetic flux is quantized in this semi-classical picture. In other words, it's locally constant. This electric flux is not in this picture. The electric flux, as we move A, still moves in this vector space, but the magnetic flux is locally constant, and the Poisson bracket of any locally of a locally constant function with any other function is zero. So we still have the commutation of fluxes. Now, how can we think of this electric flux? Well, this electric flux for fixed eta, and eta can just be thought of in this vector space. For fixed eta, this is a function on this symplectic manifold. And in symplectic geometry, if you have a function on a symplectic manifold, it gives you an infinitesimal motion. And what is the infinitesimal motion? The infinitesimal motion, as I said before, is really translation along these tori. In other words, it's the infinitesimal action of this torus, which I said this torus acts. This is the torus acting of tensoring by a flat connection on the trivial bundle. So tensoring by flat connections on the trivial bundle, that generates the corresponding observable is the electric flux. Okay? So when we go to quantum theory, we're not going to have observables corresponding to these infinitesimal motions, but we'll rather have operators. And so those operators, those self-adjoint operators, are what we would call the electric flux. But they're generated by translation by the flat connections. Now the flat connections on the trivial bundle, as I said before, is a torus. And that torus is the identity component of a very natural group, which is H1 of n with circle coefficients. So this is the group of all flat connections up to equivalence. This is the group of flat, topologically trivial connections. And, of course, there's a map out that just remembers the topology, that is to say, the Chern class. So this map is the topology. So it's the topological class of that flat connection. Now, we can't have a flat connection on a bundle of arbitrary Chern class, but the only ones that can have a flat connection are the ones which are where the Chern class is torsion. You see, because the real Chern class is measured by the curvature, and the curvature is zero. So when we go to the real cohomology, we have to get zero. And so, in fact, the group of flat connections is an abelian group, which has several components. So if I were to draw a picture, it looks something like this, where there's an identity component that has the identity, And that component is a torus. It's a subgroup. It's a torus, and it's this torus here, the one we're seeing in this picture. But there's a bigger group, as I say, and the components are labeled by these torsion churn classes. Thank you. Now, when we go to the quantum theory, which we're about to do, what we're going to do is get operators corresponding to the elements of this group. And that's an abelian group, so we'll want to diagonalize those operators simultaneously, which we can do for an abelian group. Now, if we diagonalize the operators here simultaneously, then what do we get? Well, we get the characters of that torus. Right. So I want to look at the character group. And so the homomorphisms from this torus here, H1 of N, the homomorphisms into the circle, those are going to be the one-dimensional representations of that torus. Well, the one-dimensional representations of a torus, you know that they're indexed by some lattice. And the lattice here is, by the right dualities, Poincaré, Pontryagin, this is the second cohomology of N modulo torsion. So that's the lattice we saw before, the lattice of quantized magnetic fluxes. On the other hand, if I look at this bigger group with components of flat connections, and I look at the characters of it, well, now I not only have the characters of this torus, but I have this finite group, and the way they combine is simply into the second cohomology. So that's an abelian group that that refines this, okay, that lattice.
What's the dimension of capital N?
3. It's a compact-oriented 3-manifold. Okay. So those statements are important for us, and these characters are how we're going to see in the quantum picture electric fluxes. And the magnetic fluxes we've already seen as the component of the gauge field. So now we've refined both the magnetic and electric flux to integral cohomology classes. And now we can go and see what is the quantum theory. So if we go to the quantum theory, then what we have to do is quantize this tangent bundle, this symplectic manifold. And so the Hilbert space, well, you know, how do I quantize a tangent bundle? I take L2 functions on A of N. So, for the moment, we're going to proceed with a heuristic picture of L2 functions on A of N, and then I'll show you, I'll indicate how mathematically you think about this space. But intuitively, let's think of it as L2 of A of N. So remember this picture of A of N, these connections on space, on N. We have lots of components which are indexed by the magnetic flux. So these Bs live in H2 with integer coefficients, and that's the magnetic flux. And then we have this torus acting. Okay, and now we want to look at functions here. So there's an obvious grading. So there's a grading by magnetic flux. So we can write H as a sum over these magnetic fluxes of HB, where these are just the functions that are supported in a given component. So the functions supported in a given component are the functions which carry a particular fixed magnetic flux. Well, what about the electric flux? Well, so on this space A, we have this group that I just talked about, the flat connections, acts by translation on A of N. Hence, acts by pullback, all right, on L2. Functions on A of N. So we act by the function. So we can decompose, certainly, according to this action, according to the characters of this group. So in other words, this is an abelian group acting on this big representation. This representation is not at all irreducible, so we break it up as a sum over its irreducible pieces. The irreducible pieces are labeled, they're all one-dimensional, since this group is abelian, and they're labeled exactly by the electric fluxes. So we get another grading by electric flux. And now we can see, we can ask the question about commuting is really the question, can we simultaneously grade by electric and magnetic flux? Well, you can see that the answer is no. Because supposing that we're in a homogeneous piece here, supposing we have an element, a function in a homogeneous piece here. So that's a function that's supported on one particular component here. Okay. So if we can simultaneously grade, that means that we can simultaneously locate it as an eigenfunction here. So what are the eigenfunctions for, in other words, for this action here? Well, those are the functions that, you know, just transform into a multiple of themselves under this. But how is this acting? Well, this is acting as translation by this abelian group. Well, if I translate by this torus, this identity component, then that is indeed staying inside this component of the space of connections. So it's possible we have an eigenfunction. But if I translate by an element not in the identity component, then that's moving me from one component to another. And so that's changing the magnetic flux, and therefore I can't simultaneously have something which is an eigenfunction for these operators that give electric flux and simultaneously has a fixed magnetic flux. So that's the observation. It's very simple. And I think it's very simple to understand in this context. Notice that if we back off from wanting to measure the electric flux as an integer cohomology class, but only want to measure it modulo torsion, then that we can do simultaneously fixing a magnetic flux, because those translations by this torus fix us in that component. That's a little bit unnatural in that we have an asymmetry where we're measuring magnetic flux fully, not modulo integers, torsion, but we're measuring the electric flux only modulo torsion. Okay. So that's the statement. Now, right. So how can we say that? Let me just write that as a sort of Heisenberg uncertainty between a commutation of operators. Well, to get honest operators, supposing that we have omega, which is an element of H1 of n with circle coefficients. Then, as we've discussed, we're going to have a quantum operator, which is the operator corresponding to translation by omega. That's the operator I just discussed. And at the same time, we can have a quantum magnetic flux operator corresponding to omega. What's that? Well, it's just the operator which is multiplication by the pairing between B and omega on the component labeled by B. So B is a two-dimensional cohomology class, and omega is in here. And so we could write this pairing as saying we take the cup product of B and omega, and we evaluate on the fundamental class of n. Okay? So this is a phase, an element of the circle. We've taken a cohomology class in degree 1 with circle coefficients, multiplied by a cohomology class in degree 2 with integer coefficients. We get a cohomology class of degree 3 with circle coefficients. We integrate over n, which is compact and oriented, 3-manifold, so we get an element of the circle. So that gives us a phase for each component, and we just multiply. And then the statement is, so the statement, theorem, whatever, statement is that the commutator between this magnetic flux for some omega and the electric flux for a different omega is computed as, so these omegas are both in H1 with circle coefficients, and there's this map that brings us to H2 called beta, stands for Bachstein, and so we simply take this. And the argument I've given if you think about it, really proves that theorem, that formula. So I have till 1:45, is that? Or
the next talk is what time?
3.
Yeah, 1:45.
Okay. So let me make several remarks here. One is just purely topologically. Let me just explain what this is. This is what's called the link pairing, and we started with these classes omega, which live in this abelian group I just erased. Remember, that group has several components, the identity components of torus. But in fact, this pairing only depends on which component we're in. That's what this Buckstein says. And so that link pairing, let's say tau, is a map from the torsion in H2. Let's just write H2 across the torsion in H2. And it gives us an element of the circle. In fact, it gives us an element of finite order in the circle. Now, we can think of that pairing geometrically by identifying this with the torsion in H lower 1, cycles rather than cocycles. And so here we have torsion in H lower 1. And so what this says is that we have this pairing is defined if I have some 3-manifold, and I have 2 cycles in it. Say some cycle there, and some cycle here. So this is my sort of beta of omega 1, Poincaré dual, and beta of omega 2. But these cycles are both torsion. And this is measuring, in some sense, how these are linked. But it's not the linking that we have in 3-space, right? If we have 2 knots in 3-space, we can measure how they're linked. But that's not homological. There's no homology in 3-space. This is a homological linking between these things in a 3-manifold, which has some non-bounding loops. And these loops are non-bounding. But being torsion says that they don't bound, but some multiple of them does. So in other words, if I take several copies of this loop, I can find a surface which bounds. So we can find, if I think of this loop, we can find a surface inside the manifold that, so to speak, comes in some number k times into the boundary. So the boundary is k pieces. So if you wanted to visualize an example, you might think of RP3. That's the simplest Lens space. So for RP3, the first homology of RP3 is cyclic of order 2. And if we think of RP3, there's a model where I just think of the solid 3 ball, and then on the boundary, I identify antipodal points. And in that model, the generator of the homology is the curve, which is a half great circle around the boundary, because it's a closed loop, because these 2 points are the same. On the boundary, we've identified antipodal points. Now, that's not the boundary of a surface, but you see, if I take 2 copies of it, and if you think about it, those are wrapping twice in the same direction because of this antipodal identification, then that just bounds an equatorial disk in that ball. Okay, so that's the type of picture we have here. So we can take one of these loops and bound it by a disk, and then we can look at the other loop. So now we bounded it by a surface in general, and we look at the other loop. Well, in this RP3 example, we might take this other loop to just be another copy of the same loop, but maybe transformed a little bit. So my picture is not very three-dimensional. It's kind of hard to do there. So you imagine that I have this ball, and I have, let's say, this equatorial plane is the one I've drawn, and let's just take a diameter that goes not on the equator, just say from the North Pole to the South Pole. Well, that in this space is also a loop. It's in the same homology class as this original one. And you see it intersects that disk in exactly 1 point. So that intersection number is what this linking pairing measures. Since we've taken twice this boundary, we really have to think of this disk with a coefficient of 1/2, because then I would get my original boundary there. So if we think of it with 1/2, then that intersection number is 1/2, and that would be the value of that torsion pairing. So the key fact is, again, Pontryagin-Poincaré duality that says this torsion pairing is actually a perfect pairing. In other words, given any element in this group for a closed-oriented 3-manifold, there's another element in that group which pairs non-trivially. Okay. So that means that in this commutation, as long as our manifold has any torsion at all, we'll always meet that non-commutativity. That's a topological property. That's the perfection of that pairing. All right. Now, how do we make this Hilbert space L2? And the way we make it is to use symmetry. And I said from the beginning that the space we're quantizing is the tangent bundle of an abelian group. And so let's suppose that A is any abelian group. Let's see what I want my notation. Okay. Well, yeah, before I do that, what we did, you see, in analyzing that Hilbert space is we have this space A of n, and then we also looked at the space we'll call A of n check, which are the characters on A of n. So for example, when we define this operator, you see that operator is like a character on A of n. It's a homomorphism to the circle. It's a very trivial one. It's locally constant. But nevertheless, we could look at the whole group of these, and those act on functions, right? If for each point of my group I have a phase, and then I'm looking at some function, I can just multiply point by point by these phases. So this group acts on the Hilbert space. By multiplication, this group acts by translation, and they don't commute. That's the standard non-commutativity of Heisenberg. And so we really, on the Hilbert space, get a central extension of that group. And so that's the general definition, that if A is an abelian group, then suppose we have a group G, which is a central extension of A by the circle group, and this group G is not necessarily abelian. In fact, given this situation, then we construct a map S from A cross A into the circle, and this map measures commutators. So given elements A1 and A2, which are in here, what can I do? Well, I can lift them to the group, A1 twiddle, A2 twiddle. That lifts them to the group G. And then I can multiply, I can take the commutator of those elements in G. Well, the commutator of those elements in G projects to the commutator in A. A is abelian. And so this commutator in G projects to the identity element here, therefore lives in this circle. So this is an element of the circle as advertised. And you can easily see that if I change the lift, I'm just multiplying by the circle, which is central. And since I have A and A inverse, those cancel. So this is a well-defined function, the commutator. And you can see that S is alternating, and it's a bihomomorphism. Alternating means not only is it skew-symmetric in the variables because it's a commutator, but if I evaluate S on the diagonal, A comma A, it vanishes, and it's homomorphism in each variable separately. So that's the commutator. And if S is non-degenerate, so non-degenerate means that every non-trivial element of A pairs non-trivially with some other element of A, then G is called a Heisenberg group. So that's the definition of a Heisenberg group. It's a central extension of an abelian group by the circle group in which the commutator, it's sort of maximally non-abelian in that situation, if you like. Okay? So the only center of G is just this central circle. There's nothing else in the center. Now, so what are examples? Well, if I take A to be the plane, think of it as the PQ plane, the phase space of a particle on the line, then then you have the usual commutation, the Poisson bracket being 1. We can take that to be, we can take S to pair the generator of each axis to non-trivially, and that generates the standard Heisenberg group. So that's a three-dimensional Lie group. Its Lie algebra is the Lie algebra, which is the standard commutation relations. The P bracket with Q is the central element. So that's the Heisenberg group that you know in quantum mechanics. And On the other hand, there are lots of other ones. So we could take A to be, say, the integers cross the circle. So given an integer n, and given a circle element lambda, I have to tell you how to pair these. Well, we really have a pairing on A cross A, right? So I want to write A cross A to the circle. So here I have an n lambda, and here I have an n prime lambda prime. And how do I pair them? Well, I take lambda prime to the nth power divided by lambda to the n prime power. I guess that's the pairing. Okay. And so we can get a Heisenberg group like that. And similarly, we can get a Heisenberg extension of, say, a cyclic group across itself. And all of these, each of these is an example of taking A. So for any abelian group A, we can take A to be the product group of that abelian group with its Pontryagin dual, with its group of characters. And all those are examples of that. And then there's a canonical pairing here. Okay. Well, that's the situation that we met in this Maxwell theory, right? We met this group acting by translations, and then the characters acting by multiplication, which is the Pontryagin dual. And the basic theorems about Heisenberg groups, which I won't write down, are that, first of all, if you're given such an S, you're given an abelian group A, and you're given an S, which is alternating a bihomomorphism and non-degenerate, then there is a G and its unique up to isomorphism. So in other words, you know the Heisenberg group once you know the commutators. And the second theorem is that...
unique up to isomorphism, which is the identity on A and T.
Yeah, as extensions. The extension, right. And the second theorem, loosely stated, is that any Heisenberg group has a unique, irreducible, unitary representation, which on the central circle is just the standard multiplication. So once I fix the standard character of this central circle, then we get a unique representation. Now, I've said this without topology. We should really have A being a topological group. And the classical context is when that topological group is locally compact. So these kinds of examples are locally compact, finite dimensional. But the kind of example we encounter in field theory, where we have the space of fields, that's not locally compact. It's infinite dimensional. And there you don't get a unique representation, but you need one more piece of data to specify it, and that's called a polarization. And in the physics context of these field theories, the polarization is very natural. It's the polarization by positive energy. So way back when you construct representations of the Poincaré group, you solve a wave equation, you Fourier transform, you see the Fourier transform lives on some positive energy piece and negative energy piece, and then you take functions on the positive energy piece. Well, that's the polarization. So the same story goes here. So that theorem is called the Stone von Neumann theorem, but in this generality, Mackey, Irving Siegel, Shale, all these people contribute. Okay, so finally we can see the Hilbert space of our Maxwell field as being this representation for that Heisenberg group, and then we have the operators, and this commutation that I'm talking about, this non-trivial Heisenberg principle between magnetic and electric fluxes, is simply the commutation pairing in this Heisenberg group. All right, so let me in the...
Can you say that the definition of a polarization rules on the infinite dimensional group?
After the lecture. So I want to say something about how this generalizes, for example, when we want to look at other kinds of gauge fields. So the other kinds of gauge fields I have in mind could be, say, a B field in string theory, where we're still in cohomology. The Dirac quantization condition still has to do with cohomology, but the degrees have moved up one. So instead of two-form field strengths, we now have three-form field strength. And the C field in M theory is another one of this type where the degrees move up even one more to a four-form field strength. And when we come to the Ramon-Ramon field, we're no longer quantizing using cohomology, but we're using a generalized cohomology theory, which is K-theory, some form of K-theory. So we have to generalize the kinds of geometric objects that here are connections on circle bundles. That's one ingredient. And the other ingredient is we have to come to grips with this idea of self-duality. So maybe let me say first a little bit about self-duality. Because the sort of physics issue perhaps is there. And I can illustrate that by looking at the simplest case of self-duality, which is a left-moving string on the circle. So here we're thinking of two-dimensional field theory, and again I'm thinking of space cross time. So now my manifold N is simply the circle, and we've moved down a degree from Maxwell theory. So where the field strength in Maxwell theory is a two-form, a closed two-form, the field strength here is going to be a closed one-form. A closed one-form on the cylinder space-time, which is R cross S1 with its Lorentz metric. And we have a closed one-form. And if we add the quantization condition that closed one-form have an integral period around the circle, that it be an integral class, then it's really the closed one-form I get from mapping M into the circle. And mapping M into the circle is a string moving on the circle. And saying that I have self-duality is saying I have a left-moving string. So in other words, if I have the map F from M into the circle, well, then this left-moving equation is roughly the equation that F dot, its derivative in time, is F prime, or is it minus F prime? Doesn't matter. Okay, so it's one or the other. So it's that first-order equation. Now, everybody knows that the solutions have the form that F of time and position, what do you call it, sigma, or X, on the circle is just some function, say phi, of x minus ct, where c is the speed of that guy. So it's just given by one function, phi, and that function is a map from space, our circle, at some fixed time, to the circle. So phi is a map from space to our target circle, thinking of it as the circle group. And so the space of solutions is, in fact, the free loop group of the circle. Okay. So this is playing the role here of what, in the Maxwell problem, which is not self-dual, is the tangent bundle to the space of connections. That's a tangent bundle. Here we have this space, which is definitely not a tangent bundle. It's the loop group. Now, what does the loop group of the circle look like? Well, we can write any loop in the circle, phi, of x. We can write it as follows. It has a winding number, and so we can standardize a map with winding number n by e to the I n x, just the homomorphism. So this n is the winding. Then we can multiply it by an element with winding number 0, and so that has a logarithm, and we can write its log, it is the exponential of a function into the reals, and that function into the reals we can Fourier expand like that, and we can normalize that function so that there's no zero with Fourier mode. And what's left over then is an overall constant lambda, which is in the circle. So we can always write a loop in that form, and therefore we've identified this group as a product of the circle, that's my lambda, the integers, that's my n, and then a big vector space, V, that's the vector space of all these Fourier series. Okay. And, well, so that's the space of solutions of this self-dual thing. So again, we want to write this, we want to think about quantizing this system. That's something you all know better than I do in string theory. That's one of the first things you do, but I'll tell it to you anyway. And so what you have to do is introduce Poisson brackets. Well, so there are Poisson brackets between Qn and Q minus n, and that makes this V into a symplectic vector space. But the tangent direction to this circle, which would be a Q0 here, that doesn't have any Poisson bracket with anything. So in other words, again, we have a degenerate situation, not like here, the tangent bundle, where we have a symplectic situation. And so we want to somehow assign a Hilbert space to this. Well, in fact, the observation is that this loop group is sort of self Pontryagin dual. And itself Pontryagin dual, well, here we have this symplectic pairing, so we can make an S, which is a symplectic pairing. And then what's left over is the circle across the integers. And I've already told you the circles across the integers also has that pairing. So this group is self-Pontryagin dual. Therefore, we can define this S, a commutator pairing, and therefore define a Heisenberg extension. So we get a Heisenberg extension G of the loop group. And in the theory of loop groups, this is just the standard lowest level central extension of the loop group by the circle. It's that Heisenberg group. And the representation of the loop group...
What was the V part?
The V part are the Qs.
No, of the self-duality.
The V part is the Poisson bracket.
Oh, the Qs right. And the minus,
yeah.
Minus N, plus N, minus N.
Right. So if you write the Hamiltonian for the string and you introduce the Poisson brackets, you'll see that. So that becomes a symplectic vector space. Therefore, that has that kind of pairing. We exponentiate the symplectic form, and then we have it here. So we don't get a non-degenerate Poisson structure, but we get this natural commutator pairing, which is a self-Pontryagin pairing. And so it's very natural to say that the Hilbert space of this left-moving string on the circle is the unique irreducible representation of this Heisenberg group, the representation of the loop group at that basic level. And I'm sure you all say that. But the polarization is, again, by positive energy. So you take the positive Qs.
Oh, that's what was obvious.
Yeah, the obvious polarization. So this is the energy, right? This operator of translation around this spatial circle. So why is that the right Hilbert space? Well, you know, we don't have any principle of quantizing some system. If we thought of quantizing this Poisson manifold, we might have been led to the picture I gave you first, where we had a family of Hilbert spaces parameterized by these degenerate directions. So really, I think that this is, in a way, postulating a definition for a self-dual field. And I think self-dual fields are a little bit like that, that you have to invent new rules. Certainly, in the Lagrangian description of a self-dual field, where you compute correlation functions, one meets certain quadratic refinements of bilinear forms and so on, and one is really inventing a new rule that's not the standard Feynman-Path integral. And so here, too, in the Hamiltonian picture, one meets this. Now, let me just say, conclude with just two words. One is that when we come to do this for the Ramon-Ramon field, then we'll be working on a 9 manifold, which is a spin manifold. So it's closed again. And what's the integers here gets replaced by the K-theory, let's say in type 2a, I think it's K0, of n with integer coefficients. And what replaces this torus is the abelian group, which is K-1 of n with circle coefficients. And the fluxes now are the characters of this torus group, this abelian group whose identity component is a torus, just as before. And again, this group is self-Pontryagin dual and will have a non-commutativity due to the torsion. The characters are this group, it's Pontryagin dual, and we will only be able to measure the characters modulo torsion. So the same story works for the same reason, because we have a representation of this Heisenberg group. It's just now sort of self-dual situation. So you get the same conclusion once you reach that point. But to reach that point, we would have to say, what is a Ramon-Ramon field, and so on. And there we have to be able to mix this Dirac quantization condition, which is now in K-theory, with differential forms. And so that involves a new set of ideas. And we have to go talk about generalized cohomology theory, and that's the subject of a different lecture, I think. Thanks.
This Ramon-Ramon story, that applies only for the Ramon-Ramon, the self-dual Ramon-Ramon field, not the other, not the remaining ones. You don't have any problem if the dual field, is it only a,
Well, no, you see, you can't think of the Ramon-Ramon field that way. So I want to think of the Ramon-Ramon field strength as being a sum of a zero form, a two form, a four form, a 6 form, an 8 form, and a 10 form. And in fact, we should introduce a variable u so that we actually have total degree. U has degree 2. And so this thing has total degree 0. And that means we're working with differential forms with coefficients in the Laurent series ring of U. Well, that Laurent series ring is actually the K-theory of a point, tensored the reals. U is the Bott element. And so, in fact, what we have is, if we look at differential forms on M with coefficients here, that receives a map from K-theory. Here we're looking at total degree zero. That receives a map from K-zero. And the quantization condition is this map is a Chern character, and there's really a square root of a hat genus. And the quantization condition is that this differential form be in the lattice, which is the image. And I couldn't tell you what that image was by separating out the different degrees. So the only way to tell you what Dirac quantization is for a Ramon-Ramon field is to treat the field strengths all in one shot.
Is there any story for the NSNS2 form here?
Yes, so that's a similar, that's not a self-dual field.
It's not self-dual.
Right. Now,
but it has electric and magnetic.
It has electric and magnetic fluxes, and they cannot be simultaneously measured again if there's torsion.
It's the same.
Right. Now, that field is kind of interesting in type 1 in the Lagrangian description, because to actually treat it correctly and give the extra data there, which is a quadratic form, you actually have to treat it in a self-dual way. But that's a whole other kind of story.
Do you use these Cheeger-Simons characters?
Yes, so I didn't get as far, and I should have, seeing where I am. Thank you. Given, yes. As saying that that if we were to do the kind of diagram that I talked about, where we had connections in one corner, closed forms, integral cohomology, we did that in degree 2. If we now do that in higher degrees, then what we encounter in this corner are not connections on circle bundles, but what are called Cheeger-Simons characters. So we exactly encounter those. If we want to do, for example,
that's a
these.
Tool for this
well, yes and no. So the abelian group that goes there is exactly the Cheeger-Simons character. But again, even when we do Maxwell theory, it's not enough to talk about an equivalence class of connections. We have to talk about geometric objects, a category. And so we need a category that represents the Cheeger-Simons things, with all the operations that make it a sort of abelian thing. So we need to refine it in that sense to encounter. To account for gauge transformations, essentially.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Dan again.